This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Frieda Liu. You're listening to Her Vantage, and this is where we speak to women of influence and leadership. We're talking about politics and getting more women in politics today. Now, according to the Global Gender Gap Index report in 2017 by the World Economic Forum, 28% of parliamentarians are women, 21% ministers, and 46% of countries have had a female head of state. Why do we need more women in politics, and are quotas and reserved shares the way forward? I'm here with Shannon O'Connell, who's a Senior Policy Advisor, Gender and Politics of the Westminster Foundation for Democracy, to shed some light on this. Nice to be speaking to you, Shannon.
Nice to speak with you as well, Frieda.
All right. Now, before we get into, you know, the what I started with, you know, can you tell me what's the Westminster Foundation for Democracy and the genesis of the foundation?
Sure. The Westminster Foundation, or WFD, was started in 1992 at a time of great political change. I'm sure some of your listeners can remember. Lots of it started in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, but there has always been a strong connection in the UK to Africa as well. So WFD really started as a grant-making organization trying to assist different partners and political actors that were working on the transition towards more democratic forms of government. So over those 20-plus years, the foundation has transformed also into a partnership organization that works directly with partners in parliaments, political parties, civil society organizations, as well as electoral institutions on the technical pieces of how you deliver democracy on a day-to-day basis for citizens.
Right. Now, before we talk about getting women in politics, a little bit about yourself, right? Just had a look at your illustrious career, which began in the U.S., right? So how did you end up on the other side of the pond? And were you always politically aware?
I was always politically aware. My mother often says that I was born with an overdeveloped sense of justice.
Right.
But as a young person growing up in the United States, there were transformations going on politically that are linked to the ones we just talked about. But it started in the U.S. and the U.K. in the 80s, really, with different understandings of what the social contract was between government and citizens. And even as a young person, I was very challenged by what was happening in the U.S. and globally as well, and what the U.S. was interpreting its role in the world to be. So I was even in my teenage years, was sort of involved in mobilizing and organizing to challenge some of those ideas. Homelessness is something that did not exist in its current form when I was a young person, and I saw that emerge as socially acceptable in the United States, and I couldn't understand how that could be. Mm. So all those transformations were things that drove me. As you might be able to tell from my name, for those people who are attuned to this sort of thing, I do come from a family of Irish heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So two factors brought me. I now live and work in Northern Ireland. Really started connecting with other people globally when I was working with the Democratic Party during the Clinton administration, with other younger people who were trying to make changes in their political parties and organizations. So in 1999, I first moved to Romania, actually, to work with young political activists who were doing some of the same work that I was.
Right.
So I've had a global perspective for quite a while, but have ended up here in Northern Ireland because of my Irish roots and because of very strong connections and involvements in the peace process here, and particularly the importance of women's role in delivering a social contract and enduring peace.
Right. You know, I was just looking at your bio, and one of your skills is gender mainstreaming. What exactly is that?
So as we all know, politics has a lot to do with power and power relationships. Gender, I think, in the context of politics is a word that's misunderstood in terms of its relationship. There is an assumption that gender means women, and that's not the case. What gender mainstreaming is about is understanding how we are organizing power, decision-making, access to resources, who's at the table, who gets status and the power and the authority to negotiate on behalf of different populations in our society. Gender mainstreaming means, all right, we need to pay attention to this stuff, because when we don't, we get some pretty bad outcomes and some pretty bad results and some very unstable societies. The truth is that the way we have organized many of our societies and the norms we have created about who gets paid for their work, who gets access to these resources, are strongly based around gender. So that's why this process is referred to as gender mainstreaming. And in actuality and in practice, it's really about having a very honest conversation about how we're making decisions that affect people's lives and their opportunities in those lives.
Right. You know, so I shared some stats at the start of the interview about the percentage of women in politics. Are there some startling facts that we should be aware of?
So some really good news about politics, I think, for everybody is that there are more politically active women, more women are engaged in political activity than ever before, than we've ever been able to record. And this includes running for high office, some of the stats that you shared with us at the beginning, being heads of state, ministers of defense, and all those sorts of new, relatively new experiences for women because of emerging opportunities, but also as voters, as community leaders, as community organizers. So at all levels, that's also happening for young people, for persons with disabilities. So we have higher levels of political engagement than we ever have before, which is pretty exciting. Unfortunately, in parallel with that activity, we are also measuring a pretty strong backlash against women's activism and against the political leadership that they're taking, both at the community, local level, and nationally.
Right. And I'm just, I don't really want to talk about Brexit per se, but it is a very sensitive topic at the moment. And you've got Theresa May. Does gender come into play? Do you think the reporting would be different if it wasn't a woman? Yeah, I'm just, you know, from your observation.
You know, that's really interesting. We, the Westminster Foundation for Democracy serves as a secretariat and supports an all-party parliamentary group in Westminster, so a group on democracy in the world. It's a group that looks at international politics and development. We had a meeting that was focusing on violence against women in politics from a global perspective. And there were political leaders, women political leaders from Bolivia, from Tunisia, Jordan, Malawi. But what was interesting is the number of stories of violence that women MPs from Westminster were sharing as a result of just how toxic the debate around Brexit had become.
Right.
And the differences in the type of language and the type of threats that they are receiving that are much more gendered, much more, in some cases, sexualized around the Brexit debate. And there absolutely also was conversation about the extent to which Theresa May's shoes are covered more than the withdrawal agreement.
Okay. All right. Now, so, you know, why is it crucial to have more women representation in politics? You know, what does it mean for how countries are governed? You know, because we do talk a lot more about women in the workplace, but not as much in politics.
Right. So the women's participation in politics and governance, you know, I've been doing this for a few decades, and the initial questions that we would get around women's political leadership was, well, will it make things any better? Which in some cases, the answer is it doesn't matter. The fact is they have every right to be at the table. That's one part of the answer. But the what we know now is there's been enough time and enough investment in this is that we know that women's political leadership improves the quality of democracy and government and services that citizens experience. There is a direct link between decision making that is more gender balanced and higher quality of services and better outcomes for all citizens, right, not just women and girls. Yeah. We also tend to get higher levels of stability, and we get levels of risk management that are better and better long-term planning. In politics, those things can be a little bit more difficult to measure because of the way things, because of the way policy is interrupted by elections at regular intervals. But we do know that the research that was done on the banking crisis in 2007-2008 that we all had the pleasure of experiencing globally was the banks that survived and whose clients survived were those whose boards were more gender balanced because of those factors I just mentioned, better long-term planning, risk management. So it was the combination of behaviors that are typically linked to men and women delivering, working collectively to deliver the best outcomes. So you had better management of short-term risk and long-term risk and items like that.
All right. We'll talk about some of the reasons women don't want to get into politics in just a moment. I'm here with Shannon O'Connell from the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. You're listening to Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Beautiful festive moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Her Vantage and Enterprises, where we speak to women of influence and leadership. I'm Frida Liu. I'm here with Shannon O'Connell, who's the Senior Policy Advisor for Gender and Politics for the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. We talk about getting more women in politics. Now, in a 2008 survey of 292 parliamentarians around the world, the Interparliamentary Union found that female MPs viewed lack of finance as the most significant deterrent to entering politics than their male counterparts did. So how prevalent is this issue? What are some of the things that can be done to counter that?
That's a big one. So, Frida, you were asking about getting women into politics. The three main barriers that keep women out are money. That's a big one. The other is violence. And the third one has to do with social norms. Right. The extent to women have far less leisure time for things like politics than men do. and there are perceptions of whether or not they are public citizens or private citizens that affect their ability to be involved in politics. Money is a big challenge because we know that the way money moves in politics has a big impact on women's ability to compete in their own right. It's pretty complex. It's different in each society. In some countries, it's just a matter of you have political parties, political organizations that are essentially auctioning off nomination papers to the highest bidder. So in those situations, women can't even put themselves forward as candidates.
Right.
And in other situations, you have the cost of just standing for office that is prohibitively high for anybody who isn't a millionaire. So it's a universal challenge, and there's no easy answer. It's another situation that calls for some pretty honest conversations and quite possibly regulation, regulation that isn't just on paper but is also enforced. And the challenge there, though, is it's the political parties that are sustaining the system of money in politics are the ones who would have to enforce it.
Right. So what about social norms?
So social norms, as you know, vary from country to country or from society to society. They can also exist, as you know well, in the beautifully diverse cultures of Malaysia. They can be different with different communities within a country or a region. But they have a very big impact on two factors in particular. One is women's access to resources in terms of time and in terms of money. If you look at some of the time maps that sociologists and social scientists have charted over in different societies, what you find is that men tend to have large chunks of uninterrupted time, you know, these sort of beautiful time maps where they have hours that are all the same color. Mm. And whereas women's lives are what are referred to as interruption rich. So they have far less time that's interrupted by other things going on in which they could do something like pursue politics, right? Which is a world in which you have to compete first and then you receive compensation for that competition. There are also laws around citizenship that in some countries classify women as private citizens, which means they belong in the home. And therefore, you have education systems, social systems, family systems that do not support women in seeing themselves as leaders, nor does it support communities in seeing women as leaders. Right. So those are some pretty challenging barriers for women to overcome.
Right. You know, we touched a little bit about violence, you know, for women in politics. And I've seen this happen here in Malaysia as well. So how deep is this issue? What have been some things that have been, you know, I guess, successful in some countries in stopping this?
Yeah, so it's pretty deep, I'm afraid. It is, and the growth of social media has amplified. It's created new opportunities for people to issue threats, intimidation, and abuse, and to do so in a way that's anonymous and difficult to track and difficult to police. So unfortunately, with women's political participation, it's something that's growing. And the conversation that we had at the all-party parliamentary group on Tuesday night focused very much on what political parties could do. So at this point, Bolivia is the only country in the world that has passed legislation that criminalizes violence against women in politics. The challenge that we're having is, or that our partners in Bolivia is having, is the actual implementation of that law. And in a number of countries, you do have some pretty strong pieces of legislation on the books that prevent or criminalize these types of behaviors, but the challenge is implementation. So that was very much the focus of our conversation on Tuesday night for politically active women. There is a sense that there is sufficient legislation in place that could prevent or punish or prosecute these behaviors and ideally create new norms and different choices around this, but that it's not being implemented. So that's the piece that we're looking at collectively now. How do we shift the judicial, the policing, the regulatory institutions to actually realize these protections that exist in law?
Right. You know, so what can political parties do to encourage women participation? Is it to start a women's wing? And should we even start earlier, this whole thing about getting women involved in politics? Should we even start in schools?
That's a great idea. Yes, start young. Help young women see themselves as leaders and understand that going into something like politics does not mean shifting their behaviors to what they see, which isn't always something that offers them a positive impression, but letting them know they can go into politics and bring their ideas and what the way they want to make choices and their values into that system and ask the system to adjust to them. Yeah. Political parties, though, we know to make a difference in terms of women's political leadership have to have some hard conversations, and they need to do two things. Number one, they need to identify it as a priority. So they need to not just say, to issue a statement saying, we support women's political participation, but they need to say, and this is where and how we're going to invest in this and make a difference. So, for example, in Mexico, they passed legislation where the political parties receive state funding, and they said at least 10% of that state funding must go towards women's investing in women as political activists and political leadership.
Right.
Now, the first audits of that legislation found that some parties were spending that on catering and cleaning, but because they had hired women, they thought that that was okay.
Wow. Okay.
But the audit exposed that, and now in the last elections, we saw the benefits of genuine investment in women. And we also have to recognize that men are overrepresented in politics.
Right.
And bringing women in, young people, persons with disabilities, ethnic minorities, other people that need to be part of our collective decision-making, does mean that some men will have to say, you know what, I'm going to step aside here and make room for others.
Right. You know, you were recently in Malaysia with the foundation, a session for women from several Commonwealth countries attending. You know, what was the purpose of that exercise?
So there were a couple purposes of that exercise. I think one was to have a conversation about a number of the dynamics that we have discussed. And one of the things that we certainly saw in that gathering was the quality of leadership that women bring to politics, to policy, and to the type of decisions that we need to make as communities and societies. But the challenge that we see because of some of the dynamics around politics and the way politics is structured is that women tend to choose to exercise that leadership outside of politics, outside of formal politics. So frequently in civil society, in academia, in business. But when they look at the way politics is conducted, they say, that's not for me. And certainly in that room, we saw something that we see quite frequently, which is that if there was if there were some sort of amalgamation between the world of politics and the extraordinary skills and intellect and vision that women were displaying in that gathering, we could have much better outcomes for society. So it was to have a conversation with the women leaders in that room about politics, about policy, and how they can link what they are already doing to political decision-making. The other is was to do something that we know makes a real difference, which is to strengthen networks among women who are exercising leadership because they make an extraordinary difference in their ability to amplify each other, to be heard in the political space, and also to support each other to get through some of the challenges that we've discussed in terms of backlash and resistance to their leadership.
Right. And I think this point needs repeating. And I remember attending the session and you talked about, you know, our views on politics and politicians, right? And how, I guess, when we look at politics, we're good at fighting and winning, but we're not as good at governing and leading. And I think this is where media comes into play as well. We glorify fighting and winning. We don't, you know, we don't give enough airtime, so to speak, to governing and leading. You know, so I've got work cut out for me.
You're absolutely right, Frida. Are her shoes covered or are her ideas covered?
Right. Thanks for being with us and spending time talking about this. You know, we've been discussing about getting more women in politics. I've been speaking to Shannon O'Connell from the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. You've been listening to Her Vantage and Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.